Hello, and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Celia Hatton. Well, coming up in 30 minutes, our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, reports from a place where few journalists go, West Darfur in Sudan, which has been a hotspot in 19 months of fighting.
Wow, there's still an acrid taste in the air. Smell. This place was burning. The shops are charred. The doors blown over. This is where gunmen went on a rampage.
That in half an hour's time. But first, we're going to start with the fast-moving situation in Syria. The conflict there suddenly sprung to life again after the civil war had reached a stalemate. Bashar al-Assad's government retained power, leaving about a third of the country in the hands of opposition forces. Some of those rebels, backed by Turkey, broke the stalemate when they burst into President Assad's territory, pushing east from their stronghold in Idlib to capture Syria's second largest city, Aleppo, on Saturday. Aleppo's 2 million people are now adjusting to their new reality. And now the rebels are moving swiftly south. An hour's drive further on, they say they've reached the outskirts of another hub, the city of Hama. It's home to just under 1 million people, and it's a key stop on the way to the capital, Damascus. The fighters spearheading this new push are from the Islamist militant group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, has said he won't stop at Hama. He's aiming to conquer Damascus and, indeed, the entire country. So in this edition of NewsHour, we're asking, do the opposition fighters have the resources they need to succeed? And what are the implications for Syria and its neighbours? For a rebel perspective, we managed to get a hold of Colonel Ahmed Homsi, who describes himself as a leader in the military operations department of the alliance headed by HTS. He sent us this voice note on Sunday when he said he was on the outskirts of Aleppo.
We secured the whole of western Aleppo and the whole of eastern Idlib in order to enter Aleppo city. We entered from several positions in an organized way. We were able to target regime-allied militias far away from civilians. We focused on military sites where the militias were retreating. Thank God we entered quickly and the militias collapsed and fled east. Now we are carrying on to liberate the remaining areas, God willing.
Abdul Fayyad is a Syrian journalist and filmmaker in Idlib between Aleppo and Hama. He told the BBC this morning about intensive airstrikes being carried out by Syrian government air forces.
Just a few minutes ago, Idlib city was targeted with an airstrike. And actually, this airstrike hit a Thawra neighborhood where there is a hospital there. The situation is there are an intensive airstrike on the city. It's going daily. Yesterday, there was more than 5 airstrikes. A few of these airstrikes hit crowded markets and hit also a hospital, which is the clinic hospital in a Dabit neighborhood.
And today, President Assad accused Western countries of encouraging the fighting and trying to redraw the map of the Middle East. But the Turkish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hakan Fidan, disagreed.
It would be a mistake at this time to try to explain the events in Syria by any foreign interference. This is a mistake that those who do not want to understand Syria's realities take refuge in.
Syria's biggest military backer in recent years has been Russia. In a telephone call with journalists, the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said Russia would continue its support.
Of course, we continue to support Bashar Assad, and at the appropriate levels, we will continue our contacts, analyze the situation, and a position will be formed on what is needed to stabilize the situation.
There have been reports of airstrikes by Russian and Syrian forces on the rebels in the last few hours. So how is this reignited conflict going to play out? Aaron Lund is a fellow of the U.S. Policy Research Institute, the Century International, and a writer on Syria. He's in Stockholm. I'm also joined by Barçın Yinyanç, an independent Turkish journalist based in Istanbul. Welcome to you both. Aaron, let's start with you. After such a long, quiet period, the HTS and its allied groups seem to have burst out of nowhere. But how strong are they?
Well, apparently stronger than anyone thought. And I think they're just going to get stronger now that they have Aleppo, which is one of Syria's two really big cities, and all the resources and all the people there under their control. So, but I think the what happened over the weekend is not just a result of their strength. I'm sure they are well organized. They seem to be much better organized than the rebels of the past. And they use new techniques, drones and other things. But I think what really changed the game this time was that the Syrian government lines collapsed. And that was a result of their weakness, perhaps of a lack of support from Iran and from Russia for various reasons, geopolitical reasons. And also, I think, to some extent, just bad luck for the government that they were overrun early on. And then the militias and the army armed forces under their control just turned and ran. And they never managed to sort of assemble themselves and turn around and put up defensive lines around Aleppo in time.
Just to focus on HTS and its allies, though, where are they getting their funding? You mentioned they have drones. They're very well organized. Do they have outside support?
They do have some level of outside support. It's unclear to what extent they're actually financed directly by any state. I don't think that's really a thing. But they do get support indirectly from Turkey, which is active in these areas in northwest Syria. Idlib is the region they controlled until now seizing Aleppo as well. And Turkey has troops there and protects them and has shielded them from the Syrian government and Russian and Iranian attacks in the past, and is working with them in various ways. And then they profit from the local economy. They tax it in various roundabout ways. They exploit foreign aid to some extent, even though it's a sensitive issue. So they have to stay clear of that and to not have aid supplies cut off. But they use whatever resources they have to their advantage. And they're a pretty clever and resourceful group that works with what they got pretty effectively.
Okay. Barçın, let's turn to you. Aaron just mentioned Turkey. And we just heard a moment ago as well from the Turkish foreign minister denying that Turkey is fueling this conflict. In general terms, where does Turkey stand on this push into Syria by HTS and its alliance?
Well, basically, obviously, they deny any involvement. And in fact, they say, the Turkish sources say, is that these new attacks were actually triggered previously by attacks coming from the regime forces. But actually, Turkey is frustrated by the stalemate in Syria that you have mentioned, because Turkey is hosting nearly 3 million refugees. The current government is under pressure domestically, and it wants to start seeing the return of the refugees. So it wants two things, basically. A, it has started a normalization process with Bashar al-Assad, which Mr. Assad has not answered positively. And two, it wants Mr. Assad to start dialogue with the opposition forces. And in that sense, Ankara's message today, voiced by Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan, was overlapping with that of Washington and its allies in UK and Germany and France, that basically it was Assad's responsibility that HTS has launched an attack because Mr. Assad is not willing to start dialogue with the opposition.
We've heard also today from President Assad's allies, Russia and Iran have called for coordination with Turkey on this. How might Turkey respond?
Well, actually, Turkey is already in a coordination with Russia and Iran in a mechanism called the Astana process. But again, Mr. Fidan has underlined the fact that the Astana process, which has sort of brought a relative calm, a relative frozen of the situation in the field, should have led to a dialogue between Syria and the opposition forces. And so Mr. Fidan was complaining that Bashar Assad was not taking the opportunity of this relative calm to reach out to the opposition and to talk. So there will be cooperation because Russia and Iranian militias are present in the territory. So in order not to have some kind of an accident between different military groups, Turkey is bound to cooperate with Russia and Iran. But I think the message today was clear that Ankara wants Russia and Iran to push Assad for normalization with Ankara and for a dialogue, to start a process of dialogue with the opposition.
Erin Lund, back to you. HGS says it's broken ties with the Islamist militant group Al-Qaeda, and HGS has been trying to portray itself as a more moderate group. Has that won its support inside Syria?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say who supports anyone in Syria because no side really permits free expression, and there's no elections worth the name anywhere in Syria, including under HTS control. So, but I mean, they do have a measure of support in their areas and perhaps outside them as well. And I think the very extreme line they took in the past when being a formal Al-Qaeda affiliate was not something that would endear them to most Syrians, even if it was effective to attract some hardline fighters. So I think the to the extent that they moderated their message, that is probably something that plays well in Syria. But still, it's a pretty hardline Islamist group, and you have many Syrians who do not buy that, who do not like that. Of course, the ethnic minorities, the religious minorities, Christians and Alawites and others, but also many other Syrians. So it is a group that has some support, but I don't think we should overstate it.
And Barchin, in the minute that we have left, there's a large Kurdish community straddling the border between Turkey and Syria, as you've mentioned. How do they fit into the conflict?
Well, basically, the Syrian Democratic Forces who are present in the country's north, the main group is the PKK, which is seen as a terrorist organization as Turkey, which is seen as an existential threat. And in fact, to my knowledge, U.S. is not contesting the fact that the Syrian Democratic Forces are actually led by the PKK. And Turkey has been asking Washington to stop supporting the YPG, the Syrian Democratic Forces, militarily and politically. And my feeling is that these developments are also part of Ankara's expectation that with Trump, US might be considering withdrawing from Syria.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Barchin Yenenc, independent Turkish journalist, thank you for joining us. And Erin Lund, fellow of the U.S. Policy Research Institute, The Century International. You're listening to NewsHour. More to come. Coming up in 5 minutes' time, what's been your word of the year?
I think this year in general has just been like an absurd year, so an absurd word fits.
We'll also ask how much social media is shaping the language we use. And our newsroom headlines this hour: Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has blamed Western countries for a rebel offensive that has reignited the civil war, accusing them of trying to redraw the map of the Middle East. Urgent budget talks are taking place in France to try to avoid the collapse of the government. And a court in Belgium has ordered the government to pay compensation to 5 women forcibly removed from their mothers in Congo during the colonial era. This is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Tomatoes farmed using forced labour in China are likely to be finding their way into supermarkets across Europe, a BBC Eye investigation can reveal. Forensic testing on tomato puree sold in major UK and German retailers indicates they contain tomatoes produced in China. The investigation found that suppliers in Italy are importing huge quantities of tomato paste from companies that use coercive forced labor in the Xinjiang region of China. 3 years ago, major supermarkets told the UK Parliament that they had stopped using products from that region. Runaka Selina reports.
Even on the streets of another country, Those who dare speak out about forced labour in the tomato fields of Xinjiang don't feel safe. We've come to a secret location in neighbouring Kazakhstan to meet a man we're calling Mehmet.
They told me if I don't do the job we tell you to do, you'll be sent back to the prison camp. There's a job for you in the tomato fields.
Mehmet is one of 14 people the BBC has spoken to who've endured or witnessed forced labour in Xinjiang's tomato industry. One told us how they were forced to pick 40 sacks of tomatoes a day and beaten or given electric shocks if they failed. It's hard to verify these claims, but they are consistent. China denies any use of forced labour in Xinjiang and says accusations of human rights abuses there are disinformation. But the United States has banned all imports from the region, including tomatoes. Europe and the UK have not.
The tomato industry in Xinjiang is absolutely huge. It's so big that you can see it from space.
Investigative journalist and Xinjiang specialist Alison Killing, using satellite imagery and shipping data, helped us track where these tomatoes go, with the paste packed in blue barrels.
So we managed to trace these blue barrels coming from Xinjiang, passing through Kazakhstan and into Georgia, where they were handled by a shipping company who sent them onwards to Italy.
We traced millions of kilos of this tomato paste to one major tomato manufacturer in Italy, the Petty Group. The Petty Group told us they'd stopped importing from one of Xinjiang's biggest tomato producers after it was sanctioned by the US in 2020 for forced labour.
All the paste is produced in Italy.
But filming undercover at one of its factories, we discovered around a dozen blue barrels. One was clearly marked with the name of that Xinjiang producer, dated 2023. Posing as a potential client, we met with a senior executive from the company. The Petty Group produces tomato products under its own name. It's also a key supplier to supermarkets in the UK and Europe.
It's really hard to know if tomato paste sold to consumers at supermarkets are made with tomatoes from Xinjiang. So we're collecting samples from supermarkets to test them and see where they come from.
We sent 64 samples from the UK, Germany and the US to a leading forensic testing company called Source Certain to compare them with samples from China. Cameron Scadding is Source Certain's CEO.
Trace element analysis can give an indication as to where a product has come from. What we use that analysis for is to build a pattern or a fingerprint, which are unique to the country of origin.
Our testing showed that 17 tomato purees sold in supermarkets including Asda, Morrison's, Tesco and Waitrose, and four in Germany, appeared to contain Chinese tomatoes.
And we can't be certain that they come from Xinjiang, but most of China's tomatoes are grown in Xinjiang, so we can be fairly confident that some of these tomatoes are made with forced labour.
The supermarkets all said they take the allegations very seriously, but they disputed the BBC's findings. Some said their own testing and audits show no evidence of Chinese tomatoes in their products. The Petty Group said they regularly purchased tomato puree from a supplier who assured them they did not engage in forced labour. They said in future the group will not import Chinese tomatoes.
Renako Selina. Now, how does your mental state fare after spending hours scrolling mindlessly through inane social media posts, through Instagram reels or TikTok videos? If that leaves you feeling depleted, you might be suffering from brain rot, which Oxford University Press has named its phrase or word of the year. So, how common is it, and do people think it's the right word? NewsHour's Katerina Pavluk went out to ask people if they knew what it meant.
Where you can't think straight, you're going backwards in your thoughts.
It means Sigma, Skibbity Toilet Riz.
What do you think it tells us about this year?
I think this year in general has just been like an absurd year, so an absurd word fits.
And given the choice, what word would you pick for this year?
Context. Because I think at the moment in current world affairs, we need to contextualize things.
What would be your word of the year?
AI. Because I think that's what everyone's talking about right now, and people are starting to worry about the prospect of a world where AI will be dominating. And so, yeah, I think AI might be the word of the year if that's up to me.
Well, let's speak with Fiona McPherson, senior editor at the Oxford English Dictionary. Fiona, how did you settle on brain rot as the word of the year?
We settled on brain rot through a sort of interrogation of our corpus. And our corpus is a 126 billion word database, which we update monthly. And it's taken from online news sources. So we have news reports, we have sports, technology, science stories, all of that kind of thing. And we're able to look at that to see which words have increased in usage over the last 12 months or so, compared with how they fared in the previous 12 months. Some of them may never have appeared in the previous 12 months. Some of them may have appeared in small amounts, and then they've seen this increase in usage. But it's the increase in usage that says something about 2024 in this case, because it's this year. Hmm. And that's how we come up both, well, with the shortlist to start with, and then with the ultimate winner.
Can you tell us about the shortlist? What were the words on this year's shortlist? And as a whole, what do all these words reveal about our world today?
Brain rot, of course, was on the shortlist, given that that's the winner. The other five words were demure, so in the idea of a person being reserved or restrained in their appearance or behaviour. Dynamic pricing, the idea of prices for product or services varying to changing market conditions. And then we also had lore, which is that body of supposed facts or background information relating to someone or something, often a celebrity or fictional character. Then we had romanticy, which is a genre of fiction which combines elements of romantic fiction and fantasy. And then last but not least, we had slop, which is writing, art or other material which is characterised as being badly or hastily executed, sometimes even, you know, low quality or inauthentic or inaccurate. So those were the six on there. I think what's really interesting, particularly about them, there's one of them which we would really think of as a bit more of a new word, and that would be romanticy. Our evidence takes us only back as far as 2008 for that. That's the first example we could find. But it's definitely seen an increase in usage over the last 12 months. But the other five, they're all actually quite old words, which have been slightly repurposed. None of them necessarily mean anything completely different from what they originally meant or, mm-hmm. you know, how we would first think of them. But they've slightly been recontextualized to perhaps talk about online experience more, for example, or with slop to talk about AI. And demure, of course, that became sort of famous from being used on TikTok. So I think they all, possibly one thing they're telling us is there's nothing new under the sun, but things are a little bit different.
Okay, well, thank you for taking us through that. No brain rot there. That was Fiona McPherson, senior editor from the Oxford English Dictionary. You're listening to NewsHour. Officials in Guinea say at least 56 people are known to have died in a crush following clashes at a football match on Sunday. Police fired tear gas at supporters of a visiting team when they threw stones and invaded the pitch in Zerekore, Guinea's second largest city. The BBC's Paul Ndiye is covering the story from Cameroon.
It started on Sunday during a football final in Nzerekore in the southeastern part of Guinea. And the referee had just offered a penalty in favor of the home side. And to the chagrin of the visitors, there were some resistance. And according to authorities, people started throwing stones. And then there was panic, and that led to the crash.
Can you describe what we've been able to see? I know there's some quite harrowing video available on social media. What happened during the crash?
Social media videos, which the BBC has not been able to independently verify as yet, show people distraught, people who were, of course, scared, trying to cross over, climb over walls. We see others lying motionless on the ground. And of course, there were reports that these people were in total panic over the scenes that erupted in the stadium. There was violence, fighting, and there are also reports that security forces used tear gas to try to dissuade the people from continuing in their violent path. But then the result today, as we see, is nothing to be proud of.
And what's the situation now? I understand an investigation's been launched.
Right, so an investigation has been launched. The Prime Minister says that they are looking into the affair to lay responsibilities where they should be, to see how it all began, what happened, and who were those who started this. Basically, people are waiting to see, but more importantly, people are more concerned about those who are still in the hospital receiving treatment.
And Paul, the match was controversial in itself, was it not? It was meant to honour the political leader, President Mamadé Doumbouya?
That's right. It was very controversial. It's not actually the first. There have been several of such tournaments in different parts of the country. And the opposition is seeing this as some form of a ploy by the military junta led by General Mamadi Doumbouya to trump up support for a possible candidacy when elections are called. But then the Prime Minister released a statement today saying that the football tournament is meant to reunite the Guinean people. It's meant to have them, you know, socialize and come together. It was not something that needed to turn out the way it's turned out. So basically, people are still in shock.
Have we ever seen anything like this happen in Guinea before?
Perhaps not as similarly as the one of Sunday, but back in 2009 or so, there was a stadium massacre where the junta at the time, led by Captain Dadis Camara, orchestrated the shooting of many people. It's reported about 156 people were killed during that stadium massacre. Captain Dadis Camara was just sentenced a couple of months ago to 20 years in prison. That in itself has, you know, made some people say it refreshes the memories of the past about the country and its connection to Stadia. It's nothing good at all.
The BBC's Paul Ndiaye reporting from Cameroon on the deadly crowd crush in Guinea. I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Let's focus on the Sudanese region of Darfur now. The United Nations' new humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, has said the area is facing the threat of famine, in addition to violence he described as the worst of the worst. Sudan has been embroiled in a civil war for over a year now between the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, which control most of Darfur, and the Sudanese armed forces led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is one of the few international journalists to travel to the city of Old Janayan, the capital of West Darfur. She went there with the UN team. And a warning: some listeners will find parts of this report distressing.
What's the importance of your visit into Darfur?
We've got to get on the ground and see what the needs are. So it is about starvation, but it's also about protection, because these civilian populations are under massive, massive pressure. We know about the epidemic of sexual violence, but we also know that they are being used as pawns in this terrible, terrible conflict.
All right, we can move. Okay, escort is here. Everybody mount up.
Now as we move in, we can see the soldiers of the Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary, which controls this part of Sudan. Some of them in their camouflage and topsy-turvy turbans, just kids. Allegations, too, that child soldiers are being recruited here.
Nadine from under us, radio check.
Travelling into West Darfur, it's hard to call this a road, just a dirt track cutting through this semi-desert. Very bumpy, very dusty and desolate. The odd truck piled high with people and goods. And checkpoints here and there. Just a tent on the side of the road and a few men with guns.
Oui?
Okay, we're entering Janina now. Wow. There's still an acrid taste in the air. Smell. This place was burning. The shops are charred. The doors went on a rampage. This is where a massacre happened. Looting, rape, killing, ethnic cleansing. Arab fighters, the rapid support forces, their allies against non-Arabs. It's been the story of Darfur. No one lives in these houses now to tell this story. But before we came to Darfur, we visited a refugee camp in neighboring Chad and met some people who escaped from here.
When the war started, many bad things happened. It's difficult to explain. It's something that never happened in this world.
Did you see yourself?
Yes, I saw it with my own eyes. When we were fleeing, we saw dead people on the roads. When someone with you was shot, you couldn't stop to help them because you were running for your own life. You had to abandon them. My mother didn't die, but I lost my uncle, my auntie's husband. We don't know the whereabouts of my uncle to this date.
When we were fleeing, our young brothers were killed. Some were too young to walk. Our elders escaping with us were killed. Within our family, they killed my uncles, my aunties, all the men in our family. They killed many people when we fled. My mom is here, but we don't know where my father is.
The RSF and their rivals, the Sudanese army, both deny they committed war crimes. Inside El Janina, the UN's first stop is a displacement camp here.
We are here because we want to listen to you. I know that this situation is very, very hard, very tough. I know that sometimes you must feel that the world has forgotten you.
The first speaker is a community elder, a white turban teacher.
In the past, yes, we have suffered a lot here in this camp. Yes, it's true that when the war started, some people supported SAF, some supported RSF, but we as IDPs here, we are neutral.
The UN recognizes General Burhan's government as Sudan's authority, and he's restricted the UN's access and presence. The NGOs based here told Tom Fletcher the UN had to do better.
My name is Tarek Riebel. I'm the head of operations for NRC in Sudan.
What is your message to the United Nations?
We believe that more needs to be done in the country. We see people starving. We see people dying. Even now with the floods, bodies have come up as just because they're recently buried. I mean, it's literally so visceral, the suffering.
Lise Doucette in Western Darfur. And Lise is now on the line from neighboring Chad. Lise, what are your reflections of your time in Sudan?
Celia, it is that the situation is so very urgent, so very enormous, and yet so very hard. I have to say, I was really startled. Everyone I was traveling with was startled when we saw the size of the informal camp that was in my piece just across the border from Sudan. And everywhere you looked, you could see this huge crowd and almost all of them women. And as we spoke to them, all of the women not knowing where their husbands, their fathers, the men in their family were, all of them fleeing for their lives, fleeing acute hunger, the specter of famine in Sudan, in Darfur, and also fleeing these horrors of war. And when you go inside Darfur and see what they fled, it is so chilling. And you realize just, you know, the impunity of this war, the readiness of the armed forces. It's not just the main protagonist, the Sudanese army, the SAF, whose army chief, General Burhan, heads the government, and then the rapid support forces. With every month, as hunger intensifies and people become more desperate and arms proliferate, there are more and more arms, which means every time you deliver a convoy of this desperately needed food, you are running the gauntlet of, in one community after the other, people who've taken up arms, stopping the food, not because they're bandits, but because they're hungry.
And so there is, I keep remembering when Antonio Guterres was the head of the UN's refugee agency, he kept repeating time and again that humanitarian problems don't need humanitarian solutions, they need political solutions. But there's still no light in this tunnel of finding a way out of this war.
Lise, thanks for talking with us. That was our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. To Washington, where the outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden has done what he promised not to do. He has pardoned his son Hunter for all the crimes, including all of his crimes, including filing fraudulent tax returns and failing to pay taxes. Those are crimes for which Hunter Biden may well have gone to prison. In June, President Biden was still maintaining that he'd respect the legal process.
I'm extremely proud of my son Hunter. He has overcome an addiction. He's one of the brightest, most decent men I know. And I am satisfied that I'm not going to do anything. I said I'd abide by the jury decision, and I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
Well, let's speak to the BBC's Jessica Parker in Washington, D.C. Jessica, how is President Biden justifying this U-turn?
Well, we haven't heard from him in terms of him speaking. What we have had is a lengthy statement that dropped last night, and it was a bit of a bombshell. It was the end of America's Thanksgiving holiday break. And in that statement, he said he believed that his son, Hunter Biden, had been selectively and unfairly prosecuted. He said Hunter Biden had maybe been treated differently to other people facing similar kinds of allegations, and that he'd been singled out because he was Joe Biden's son, and that in trying to break his son Hunter, they were trying to break me, Mr. Biden said. And interestingly, he added that he believes in the justice system, but he believes that raw politics infected this process, and that he'd wrestled with the decision, but he hoped the American people would understand. So a lengthy statement that dropped last night and has drawn a wide political reaction.
What are the ramifications of this? President Trump is expected to issue his own pardons when he comes into office, right?
Yeah, so President Trump has talked before and actually mentioned it in his statement reacting to this about plans to pardon at least some of the people who took part in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. And reacting to Mr. Biden's announcement, the president-elect said, does the pardon given by Joe to Hunter include the, as he puts it, January 6th hostages who've now been imprisoned for years? And he described the whole thing as an abuse and miscarriage of justice. So the prospect that Donald Trump could issue pardons along those lines, obviously extremely controversial, and people are waiting to see exactly what happens and who might be pardoned once he comes to office. And look, I mean, it's worth saying as well that Mr. Trump, when he was president, he pardoned some allies as well. And pardons have been issued by presidents in the past. But I think for Joe Biden, you know, it's his son, an extremely close relative. And as well, as you were just pointing out, the fact that he and his team said again and again and again they were not going to do this. But he's obviously changed his mind in these last couple of months of office.
Just to focus in on Joe Biden's own party, how are Democrats reacting to all of this decision?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a mixed reaction, to be honest with you. I mean, you'd expect a chorus of criticism from the Republican side, and that's certainly happening. I think some people are more on the Democratic side sympathetic to Joe Biden. They buy into the arguments that he is making about trying to pardon, you know, his only surviving son. But there is also people who are criticising the decision. So one of them, a Democratic congressman, Greg Stanton, he posted on social media that while he respects Joe Biden, he thinks he got this one wrong. He says it wasn't a politically motivated prosecution, that Hunter Biden committed felonies. So I think it's drawing a mixed reaction from within the Democratic base. You know, I think for Democrats, as they look ahead to a Trump presidency and the sort of things it might involve, there's a danger for them that they're going to be potentially accused of hypocrisy.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Jessica Parker speaking to us from Washington, D.C. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Well, let's turn to an international legal battle that's finally getting its day in court at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. In 2019, a group of students from the Pacific Island country of Fiji teamed up with other nearby the island countries under threat of climate change. They launched a campaign arguing that climate-polluting countries have a legal obligation to repair the damage linked to rising temperatures. Let's go to The Hague now and speak to Joey Chowdhury from the Center for International Environmental Law. Joey, how big a deal is this?
Oh, it's a huge deal. It's a watershed moment for climate accountability. In a world where we're seeing escalating climate devastation, we just saw Storm Bert impacting communities in Wales and England. In India this year, we surpassed 45 degrees Celsius. What's being asked of the International Court of Justice to really clarify what states are supposed to do under international law in relation to climate change and how they can be held accountable if they do not meet these requirements, that has the transformative potential to advance climate justice and human rights.
Could a court decision from the ICJ really compel countries that don't want to increase their climate ambitions to actually change course?
I think it could. The ICJ, you know, they can provide authoritative interpretation of binding international law. So it can provide the legal blueprint that we need to hold major polluters accountable and affirm the right to remedy and reparations. Because the power of the law doesn't always lie in just enforcement. It lies in aligning understandings of what the law requires us to do and what it does not. And what we've also said, you mentioned that it comes out of these, you know, very inspiring campaign efforts from the Pacific. And now we've seen it rooted in campaign efforts across the world that are accompanying this process. And that also leads to like a foundational basis for campaigns to advance much needed systemic change. So like it'll be an additional tool in a campaigner's toolbox to pressure their governments once this opinion is out.
Joey, when do you think we're going to get a ruling?
I think we'll get a ruling sometime next year. In 2025.
And how do you think it's going to play out?
I think, you know, this is in, it's coming together with this climate advisory opinion that was issued by the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. And also with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights is looking at similar issues. So I think we'll see a clarification of the law. I think we will see, it's hard to speculate, right? But I think that the court will affirm that multiple sources of international law, so not just the UNFCCC or the Paris Agreement, but human rights, the laws of indigenous peoples, the customary international law, these apply. And if a breach can be established, then states can be held accountable for climate devastation that we're seeing today. So they would, I hope, to see an affirmation of reparation and remedy.
Okay. Joey, thank you. That was Joey Chowdhury from the Center for International Environmental Law. Let's hear from one of those backing the case at The Hague. Vishal Prasad is the campaign director of the Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change. How has his home of Fiji been affected by climate change?
Back home in Fiji, I think the impacts of climate change and what we've been seeing on ground have been getting far more severe as the days go by, as the years go by. I think one very clear example of this is the number of cyclones and storms that we're getting right now. These used to be a few cyclones every once in a while that were below category 3 storms, so not severe cyclones. But now every year it's become almost like a routine that we're getting category 5 storms that completely devastate communities, homes and villages and communities that were not able to withstand these storms, people losing their homes, their lives even, their livelihoods, their farms, plantations, etc. I mean, the impacts of cyclones are becoming far more severe. And so it's extremely difficult to weather these and to recover from these as well. We've also had sea level rise becoming extremely severe now with many villages in total in Fiji right now. There are 40 villages that have been identified as needing relocation because of sea level rise. What we're seeing right now is just an escalation of impacts now, but it's only going to get worse into the future. And something that we in our campaign have always been trying to emphasize is what is the toll of all of these impacts on the rights of people? And what does this mean on people? And so their right to food, their right to life, and their right to live with dignity is essentially gone because of climate change. And so this is why we've been pushing for this campaign at the ICJ.
Vishal, I understand that you joined the initial group of law students in Fiji who had the idea to put this case forward quite early on in 2019. Yes. When did you feel like this movement was really starting to gain some momentum?
Well, when I first heard about the campaign to seek an ICJ advisory opinion, it was something that really struck out to me because this was a campaign that was very specific in its approach, very targeted and very focused in how it can affect change. We had a simple path ahead. We needed to get the majority of the countries in the world to accept the resolution at the UNGA, and then we have to move forward with the ICJ. And then you get an opinion that has immense potential. So there was a clear path, a clear strategy, and a strong impact that can be possible with this. And I think that was something that struck out to me when I first heard about this campaign. And I think from the beginning, we have been moving from strength to strength in this campaign. I never would have thought how big this case has become right now, because it's literally the biggest climate case in the world. So yeah, it's exciting to be part of it.
It's the ultimate David and Goliath battle, isn't it? One group of law students from a tiny Pacific Island country has now taken a campaign to The Hague.
Absolutely. I mean, this is about the people that are most vulnerable, about the frontline communities whose voices have really been ignored for so long. And this is our attempt to turn the tide on this, challenge the status quo and get these voices heard, get these people the justice that they rightly deserve. I mean, the campaign has been about climate injustice, about what vulnerable communities face on a day-to-day basis, having contributed zero, very minimally, to the climate crisis. And so really an attempt to bring and center the narratives, the lived realities of people within a process that has been so hostile to them and so ignorant of their views and their plight. Now we have a chance to change this at the ICJ.
Do you think you'll win?
Well, we're very optimistic. How we've been going and the response we've been seeing, we're very optimistic that the ICJ will issue an opinion that can move the needle, ratchet up ambition, build transparency and accountability within existing systems and really amp up climate justice.
Vishal Prasad, campaign director from the group Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change, speaking to us from The Hague. We'll continue to follow the story and we'll bring you updates when we can. But for now, that's it for this episode of NewsHour. From me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team here, thanks for listening.